From London, we present Orbit 10, a play in 6 episodes by Peter Elliott Hayes. Episode 6, The Unseen.
Lambert here. This is the last time I shall be speaking to you. I've done what I intended. And now only those last unforgettable days remain to be told. A tenth planet, 5,000 million miles distant. And yet on that windy November night, no farther than the flickering green rod in a Kensington building. This was the link. A frail door separating our world from a frozen giant on the rim of space. Now it was opening. And what would cross the threshold. Here is Dr. Petrie's 6th and last recording.
Final notes on 10th planet. We had had our warning. The signals had told us the true purpose of this scattered network of cylinders. And now the hour of the rods had come. Not now to absorb another telltale specimen of our Earth, but to send something through. But our understanding had come too slowly. Even as Clifford's hammer rang on the unbreakable green surface, I knew we were too late. I felt as he did. Nothing could destroy this thing, nothing. We hurried to my study, then telephone calls to Bancroft, head of the college, to the Ministry of Science, to the police. I felt we were going to need their help. Meanwhile, the terrible freezing went on. Some hours later, the whole corridor passing the laboratory, for full 30 yards each way, had become one shining, low-roofed tunnel of solid ice. Out of it swept gusts of bitterly cold air. It was like looking into the dead, green-lit heart of an iceberg. And somewhere in the dim, frozen cavern that had been the laboratory, the rod still throbbed angrily. The night passed. The freezing continued. But nothing more. With the dawn of Sunday morning came fog. A blanket of good, honest fog beneath which all London peered and coughed, and which shrouded the Victorian spires and turrets of the college. 10 o'clock, we were back at my house for welcome coffee and buttered toast, and a telephone bell I was beginning to dread. It was Elizabeth who saw the black and silver limousine stop outside, and the short, overcoated figure who hurried up the steps. It was Lord Heatherton. And the minister, it appeared, had set many wheels in motion.
The college told me I'd find you here. Well, Doctor, I had my own forebodings, but nothing as alarming as this. Perhaps we shall get a clearer picture when McLaren deciphers the rest of those signals.
He's on his way here now. He's flying down from Scotland. We should know something soon.
I hope so. Meantime, that rod is turning your college into one huge refrigerator.
It certainly is.
Creating the conditions they are used to.
Undoubtedly.
Well, the police are watching from every possible vantage point.
Yes.
If any other phenomena develop, we shall hear.
Good. And the other cylinders, this may be the first of many.
You recall that red file?
Yeah, I do.
We're putting the emergency measures into effect at once.
Oh.
So long as the plotted cylinders are passive, they will be left for the time being. But wherever activity is seen, I'm afraid it is going to be dealt with. After that warning, we can take no chances.
Mm.
How dealt with, sir? The army. Bulldozers and excavating parties first. Then troops with mortars and demolition charges. If that is not enough, there are tanks and heavy artillery standing by.
Oh, my word.
And if necessary, there is bomber command.
Explosives? I wonder.
I think we can cope. That specimen in the college is the one we must watch.
I quite agree.
That is our guide to what to expect later from all the rest. If that turns out to be a damp squib, there may be nothing to worry about.
Let's
hope so. No, I must get back to Whitehall. Reports from the War Office should be coming in any time now. If there is any news, let me know at once. Certainly.
Yes, of course.
Lord Heatherton's car slid away into the fog. A few minutes later, a taxi chugged out of it and deposited McLaren and Peter Garrick on the pavement.
With the future of the world in the balance, I observed Campbell still found 3 minutes to wrangle with the driver over the fare. But when he was pacing my study, gripping a bundle of papers, there were grim lines around his mouth, and his eyes were without hope.
Aye, we decoded the rest. The last section on the plane coming down. We chartered a private one at Renfrew. It's all here, Hayward.
Yes,
an intelligent, lucid history. Successes and setbacks on a world we can't even begin to imagine. And a disaster.
Disaster?
Look, it'll save time if Garrick just gives you the gist of it. Tell them, Peter.
The 10th planet is inhabited. Not by one dominant species as here, but by two.
By two?
Yes, two races who've always kept to their respective sides of the planet. Alien, hostile, endlessly at what we would call a cold war.
No truer world in those temperatures.
No, quite so.
The inhabitants of the side receiving what little light and heat there is are highly advanced technologically. 50 years ago, in our time, they perfected the system of sending the surveying cylinders across space to Earth, which they considered the planet most likely to support organic life.
I see.
The method we know now, how the cylinders assimilated samples, dismantled them into individual molecules, and beamed them back. At the other end, there are special receivers, and they're reintegrated for examination. Well, so far, so good. And this, originally, was the only purpose of the cylinders. Then the blow fell.
What blow?
Well, they were suddenly and ruthlessly overrun by the inferior beings from the other face of the planet. The signals refer to them as the Dark Ones.
The Dark Ones.
They took control of the system and soon discovered that the samples coming back were rich in chemicals and minerals.
Substances rare to them.
Yes, we became a desirable bait, an ideal potential mining colony.
Of course.
Gravity, free water, and plenty of solar heat.
Yes, I see.
And the means were already here, planted in 1,000 different spots. So the plan took shape. First, communication.
To assure us of the harmlessness of the rod.
Yes. And then, themselves. To explore Earth at first hand.
The Dark Ones. They're very confident in themselves, Hayward, because they've done it once already.
What?
Our moon.
The moon?
Chosen for a pilot experiment.
No.
They landed cylinders and sent a number of their creatures through. It worked, and they got back. Now they're ready for the full-scale operation. Us.
The next step.
Yes, the next step.
What the Dark Ones did not discover was a high-frequency radio transmitter, another part of the original survey. It had been beaming signals for a long time, in the hope of making semantic contact with us. And it was continuing to operate in secret. But now, it sent out warnings. Endless, repeated warnings. There was just a chance we might understand and be ready.
And, that's all?
No, not quite. There's another short sequence, but it's very distorted. I'm still working on it. I think the Dark Ones have detected the signals, and I think they're jamming them.
And nothing to tell us what these beings, these Dark Ones, are like.
Oh, nothing at all. What could evolve out there? Gravity to make a human weigh 500 tons. Perpetual near darkness with temperatures close to absolute zero.
Incredible. Those cells, a human would be 3 miles high. We can't begin to imagine, Campbell.
No, indeed.
And we can't wait and wait until that ghastly thing up there.
Maybe the waiting's over.
Yes. Yes, speaking. I see. When was this? Yes, I'll come at once. College. Something's happened. The rod has stopped.
Stopped?
Yes. But there are still noises. New noises. We'd better go.
Over the freezing, the vibration, but now there's something else.
comes and goes. Listen. You hear? Not in the laboratory, though it's on that side of the building. Lower down.
And it seems to be moving about.
We must go up. If we can get close enough to see.
Wrap yourselves up. No one take their gloves off. The cold up there is terrible.
We climb the 6 flights again. Frost on the stairs. Our feet left prints in it. Now almost the entire 3rd floor was a nightmare Arctic landscape of ice. But it was dripping, thawing. We picked our way along white tunnels that had been corridors and reached the laboratory. There was a mound of solid ice. The Densolite cubicle entombed. It was silent. And then... we followed the sound, stumbling and slithering along the ice-encrusted passages. It was a strange, unreal hunt, our breath making white clouds in the freezing air. We reached the landing with the lift and stopped.
Hey, well, look. Those lift gates, the steel trellis, ripped to pieces.
And the sliding doors, like a car's been driven through.
This lift stuck on the floor above. Don't go too near the edge. It's a long drop.
Do you hear it? It's coming from the shaft. I must...
Don't lean out there, sir. One slip and you've had it. Just kneel down. I'll hold on to your coat.
Can you see anything?
Yes. Yes, I can. There's something down there. It fills the bottom of the shaft. Gray. Moving. Pulsing. But not solid. More like a cloud. But it has a kind of outline, a shape.
It has happened. One of them has come through. Now the police took matters into their own hands. In 10 minutes, Cromwell Road was empty and closed to traffic. Surrounding buildings were emptied, and their bewildered occupants escorted out of the area. Still the fog pressed down. It was soon clear that the gray vapor was seeping out of the lift shaft into the basement. The rumbling grew more frequent and more violent. Now things were happening in Simmons' domain, and he led us down to a storeroom where there was a ventilating grill through which the basement could be seen. We peered through... and there it was. Vapor. A gray, shifting pool. Shapeless, yet keeping a compact mass with a dull, billowing surface. Still for long minutes, then flattening and rolling silently as if seeking a way out.
Incredible.
And that's it. A living, solid thing.
Living, but not solid. Well, it's logical, of course. A planet as massive, as cold as that. Beings with very loose molecular structure. Not affected by the tremendous gravity. Little more to our eyes than a gas. Able to expand or contract themselves at will.
And cold. Cold as the place they came from.
We went up again to meet Tom Lambert hurrying across the hall.
Mr. Lambert, come to say I told you so. I think this is no surprise to you.
Well, the cylinder's operating in reverse, you mean? It struck me as a possibility.
Oh, it struck you as a possibility. Not worth mentioning, of course.
Sorry, Doctor, but it was only a guess. And I assumed they could be knocked out if they got troublesome. Seems I was wrong.
Mr. Lambert, we are not your admiring readers. You needn't dramatize it.
Sorry. But listen, the reports coming into the War Office, they're not good. Several of the cylinders have had the full treatment, shot out and blown up. The casings have split, but the rods haven't even cracked.
Oh, great heavens.
They tried tanks on Exmoor, but the engines froze before they could get near.
Well,
the Air Ministry are ready to try pinpoint bombing where they can, but if armor-piercing shells won't even scratch...
I was afraid of this. Has,
Has anything else been reported?
Yeah, several of them are operating violently. You know, green light, intense cold.
Aye, that's the pattern. 14 hours of freezing. The energy build-up, and then the breakthrough. This one is ahead of the others.
Excuse me, Doctor, please, here.
Yes, Superintendent.
Doctor, we've got some asbestos suits from the fire service. Two of my men have got into the basement.
What? Oh, for heaven's sake, they...
Oh, they needn't have worried. Apart from about 10 tons of ice, it's empty.
What?
The doors out of the car park have been torn off their hinges. Whatever it is that was in there, it's gone.
And then, in the fog, the real hunt began. By now, visibility was down to a few yards. One heard things. Footsteps, a car engine starting, a voice calling. But they seemed on the other side of a soft white wall. Constables groped about with flashlights, keeping in touch by blowing their whistles. The police cars crawling cautiously, their headlights glowing like pairs of yellow eyes, fanned out, and others converged to join them from all over London. We stationed ourselves on the pavement outside the college by the superintendent's car. Its radio, in constant touch with the Scotland Yard control room, chattered continually, and its operators scribbled on their pads and handed the messages out to us. But we knew we were helpless.
Yes, fog. The thing couldn't have a better camouflage. The black cat in the coal cellar had nothing on this. And the thing is, what would it do?
Well, everything here is strange to it, Superintendent. It must explore. I think it will be cautious at first.
And anyone meeting it?
The only warning may be the cold. After that... By the way, where is Peter Garrick?
He stayed behind at your house.
Yeah, I guess he wanted to keep working on the last sequence of signals.
Message from 7-2, sir. Junction of Brompton Road and Beaufort Gardens.
Right.
Here's something.
Ice in Brompton Road. A continuous trail. Some shop windows broken.
So it went that way, moving northeast.
Something gray seen on the road. They tried to shadow it, then the car engine packed up.
So it can absorb energy on its own.
Thank goodness it's Sunday. That road any other day and the shop's all open.
7-2 through again, sir. They've abandoned their car.
Let me see. A bus coming down Knightsbridge, its engine stopped too. Ice began to form all over it. Only a few passengers, they got off all right. Wilkins?
Yes, sir?
Tell them I want cars patrolling square. Knightsbridge, Kensington Road, and Sloane Street.
Right, sir.
Report the moment they have engine trouble.
Yes, sir.
That seems the best indication.
Yeah, I think it is.
If we could only confine it to one area. But how do you try to stop a drifting patch of vapor?
It's hopeless, Hayward. It can go where it likes, do what it likes. There is no way of stopping it.
Another nerve-wracking hour passed. Things were found. An abandoned frozen bus, a thawing trail of ice, 15 feet wide, ending abruptly. Then more scraps of information. A frozen tree in Montpellier Square. A bent lamppost in Rutland Gate. A greenhouse collapsing under a coating of ice in Ennismore Gardens. It seemed to be moving north now, through the squares and back streets south of Hyde Park. The strangest thing was that, although it was traversing a thickly populated area, nothing had been seen. We were completely baffled. Until...
Here's trouble. This message. Prince's Gardens, a chimney stack collapsed, went clean through the roof. Occupants of house away. That was lucky. Nothing seen except a thick layer of ice on the roof.
Then that's the answer. Why, nobody's seen it. It can move about, clear of the ground. Whenever it encounters an obstacle, it just goes over it.
Encouraging having you around, Doctor. So it's moving west now. If only it would settle for a short while. Perhaps we could do something.
For another anxious 40 minutes, nothing. The trail seemed completely lost. And then a voice suddenly crackled from the dashboard radio. A report short and urgent from a police car patrolling Kensington Gore on the south edge of Hyde Park. A report so strange and ominous that the superintendent could contain himself no longer. We bundled into his car and the one behind and swept away into the fog. Fifteen minutes later, we were standing on steps that were slippery with ice.
Behind us reared the tall, ornamented spire of the Albert Memorial, and beyond, the empty wastes of Hyde Park. Across the road loomed the immense domed roundness of the Albert Hall. We knew then where the trail had ended.
Look at the place. Covered in frost from the steps to the roof.
It's in there, in the Albert Hall.
Some of the doors were found smashed in. One of the caretakers went to investigate. There was the gray stuff seeping everywhere, along the passages, pouring over the galleries into the arena. He nearly collapsed with cold.
Then it's expanding, growing.
I'm afraid it is, but at least we know where it is.
Doctor.
If this goes on, it'll shake the whole building down. It's getting out of control, Petrie.
There's another call. It's Peter Garrick.
Looking as if his life depended on that piece of paper.
Peter, what is it? I couldn't find you. That last passage. I've got it. It may be some help.
Good.
It's in fragments, but... Oh, there are some figures, a formula, I think. But the rest, this is the point. The rods require energy to function.
Aye, we know that.
But it must be in controlled amounts. They cannot tolerate too much at one time. It can damage them. Their one weakness.
An excess of energy, of power. Oh, if we could only... Oh,
that's attacking that thing in the laboratory. It's not going to affect that. Not now.
I'm not so sure. That information was not sent without reason. In some way, the organism may still depend on the rod. There might be a way. The cyclotron in the atomic energy department at the college. It gets tremendous voltages.
Yeah, from the diesel electric generators.
Yes. They can be started up in a few minutes. They're on the ground floor, though. I have an idea, but it'll mean hard work and enough hands to do it.
I guess we can raise those, sir.
Then let's go back. Fog or no fog, Superintendent, your men have got to drive. There's just a small chance, but every second is going to count. It was a thin thread of hope, but we had to clutch at it. At the college, Clifford checked the fuel tanks. They were full. With six willing constables, we raided the electrical engineering floor for tools and a heavy drum of high-tension cable. The massive bank of generators was in a wing on the ground floor. The cable was run out. Clifford and McLaren were left to bear the end and connect up the steel and copper core. The rest of us set to work manhandling the cumbersome wooden drum up six flights of stairs, unreeling the tarred cable as we went. It was easier to reach the laboratory now, though much ice still remained. With hammers and wrenches, we chipped and levered until we'd freed the rod and toppled it from the cubicle. With numb hands, we rolled in the cable drum and unwound some more turns. I wanted a contact as close as possible. Four slithering policemen, straining on an iron bar, raised one end of the silent rod, and the rest of us struggled with the leathery serpent until we'd passed three loops round it. The telephone, now working again, ran. It was quivered. The cable was connected up. We should soon know now. I made everyone stand back and gave the signal to run up the generators. It was Elizabeth who remembered that the Albert Hall could be seen from the college roof. Telling Clifford to increase the current steadily, we hurried to the iron staircase and were soon standing among the chimney stacks and skylights, peering across the jumbled Kensington rooftops. The fog seemed thinner up there. We could just make out the domed mass of the Albert Hall a quarter of a mile away. It had a strange, white, luminous appearance.
Ice.
The whole place is smothered in it.
The power should be building up by now. At full speed, those generators produce enough to supply all London twice over.
And more than enough to burn out that cable. What are we doing, Edward? Fighting something we haven't a chance against. We're so small, so weak against that.
That's what I was thinking. Wait. Listen.
But if we can hear it from here, it's growing stronger. The strength there, unimaginable strength.
Doctor, the rod is growing again. Getting brighter as the current increases.
And it is absorbing the power.
But Hayward, don't you see? We're not attacking it. We're helping it. Feeding it with energy. This is just what it wants.
I can't help it. Those signals can't be wrong. It's a chance we must take. It may be our only hope.
If this goes on, that thing's growing. If it shatters the building and bursts out, Petrie, you must stop this.
I can't, Edward. Those voices, I believe them. I believe they wanted to save us.
What can we believe? There's no truth anymore. Do you want to unleash that? for pity's sake, tell Bowen to cut off the generator.
No!
If you don't, you may be responsible for it.
Hear that? It's in the building. It must have been in the laboratory. Come on.
The rod, when we all stood staring at it, had changed. It was dull and clouded. It had cracked in a thousand places. The tracery of silver wires was black and fused. It had seemed too much to hope, but it had happened. We clung to our hope as we raced to the other call. And when, 15 minutes later, we were standing in the ice-cold amphitheater, we knew the threat had passed. Water dripped everywhere, but it was empty. Within minutes of the fusing of the rod, the vapor had become still, thin, and disappeared.
It out. And this thing couldn't survive without it.
Mm. And if that rod couldn't take it, nor can any of the others. They can all be treated in the same way.
Yeah, any powerful electric circuit run near them. Well, I guess all over the world, a lot of electricians had better get busy.
Yes, it must be done as soon as possible.
It came a long way, and this was the end of the journey. Did it hate us? Did it only want to conquer and destroy? Or, at the end, was it just trapped and alone? Could we have understood it?
The tragedy is we shall never know. But there is a lesson, perhaps, for us. If we ever go out into space, as we shall, we must leave our differences, our quarrels behind. If we carry them with us to other worlds, as these did, we shall be condemned from the start, as they were. That, I suppose, ends my notes. The rest, that has become history. The burning out of the cylinders, wherever they were found. The fading away of the signals, which have never been detected since. Whether because they had served their purpose, or because the senders were themselves overrun, we can only guess. But the link with the 10th planet was broken. Perhaps for all time. That was all years ago. As I sit here and dusk falls over the green countryside, I wonder, is it a law of the universe that each race be bound to the surface of its own world, that we belong where we begin, a law that will eventually punish all who flout it? I do not know. But, as I say, I wonder.
That was Felix Felton as Dr. Petrie in the final episode of Orbit 10, written by Peter Elliott Hayes. The music was taken from The Ritual Dances from A Midsummer Marriage by Michael Tippett. And the play was produced for the BBC by David Davis.